Rated T to M.
You've met Andrew Ryan and visited the underwater world of Rapture. You might have encountered the malevolent AI Shodan and a collective species of alien that calls itself the Many. However, chances are you haven't heard the stories of the individuals who bring both these characters and the worlds that they inhabit into being. In this podcast, we tell these tales in our own words. Really, it's not about who here does what, but how who we are informs our contributions to a rational studio culture, as well as the games we make. I'm Sean Elliott, and this is Irrational Behavior. The theme of today's show is Ideas That Died. We'll explore what happens when ideas run into technical restrictions, a lack of clear consensus, and their own convolution. You'll glimpse abandoned Bioshock tidbits, as well as an until-now unrevealed game from 4 years ago, when Irrational backed away from a zombie invasion. Part 1. Pitiful. Artist Sean Robertson's recycling bin is filled with shameful secrets. The thing is, he only ever seems embarrassed by them when someone suggests that they're embarrassing. Pretend otherwise, and his apologies are all fist pumps.
We had slug bugs as gatherers. We didn't have little girls. We had these little slugs. And Ken was really adamant that you're empathetic towards these slugs. Like, you don't want to kill them for some reason. And I don't know why it took us so long. We had almost final animation. We had AI working. They went in and out of vents. And it's like, who gives a crap about these slugs? Like, they're fucking slugs. So the call went around to the office. We're like, we need to find something that you can empathize with, something that's pathetic, something that the character will feel bad about killing. That was the mandate. So I was like, pathetic. Like, what's really pathetic? And then somehow I came across this site where people could buy wheelchairs for their paralyzed dogs. So I decided to do a sketch of a dog in a wheelchair. And I got the reference from there. There's a picture. It was a German Shepherd running on the beach with a Frisbee in its mouth. But it's, you know, it was attached to a wheelchair. And there was like this little tiny poodle running next to it with like a tiny wheelchair. It was like, you know, the pathetic dog patrol on the beach. So that's where I drew my inspiration from. And the minute I put that thing on the forums, it's been legend ever since, just how bad of an idea it was. I think after people started laughing, I was like, I was just kidding, man. It was, you know, dog in a wheelchair. But somebody drew a chipmunk. I believe our art director drew a frog with a funnel coming out of its ass. So there was, you know, there are lots of misdirected things going on here. And somehow the dog in a wheelchair bubbled to the top as like the thing that you point at and say, don't do this. I think Ken used it in one of his keynotes as, you know, examples of how not to do art in video games. So, yes, I was thoroughly embarrassed.
Part 2. I have some concerns. Determining whether or not an idea will work isn't always as attractive as devising a new one. Programmers Chris Klein and John Abercrombie perform triage on impractical plans.
All right, so we have this guy. His name is Chris Klein, and he's in charge of facilitating the content creators' ideas. And when they come up with these ideas, he's often there, and he'll say, no, we can't do that. And we call that being declined. That's his last name. The joke is, last name's Klein, and you've been declined. And what that means is that he's probably thought about it much more than you have in coming up with the idea and said, no, that's going to be really tough to do. We're going to spend a lot of time on that, and probably the results aren't going to be as good as what you're thinking in your dreams, I guess, right now.
So, like, people don't usually get declined right from the start. Usually what happens is they hear the magical words, like, I have some concerns. And that's like, you know, John or I saying, like, well, what about this situation? What about this situation?
How do you feel about that, Chris? I mean, I've heard you refer to declining yourself.
It's better than my title at my last job, which was Dr. No. So I'm kind of reprising my role here. part of our job is to start with this giant pile of crazy ass ideas and whittle them down into, you know, something that we can actually achieve. Because, look, you got limited time, you got limited funds, limited resources, but you have to put out a high quality product. And there's a million cool things you could do in your game.
The thing is, like, usually when the content creators come up with, like, any sort of ideas, they consider how cool the idea is. Like, it would be awesome if this guy did this. But they don't consider, like, all the edge cases or how it relates to other features. Like, that may be a really cool thing, but what happens if he gets shot in the middle of it? Nobody ever thinks about those sort of questions. Like, what happens if this guy gets shot in the middle of jumping in through a window? And what should... To make a really quality product, how is that supposed to look? Like, what should happen there? Should he, like, react to it? Should he just keep going? And so, you know, these ideas are usually great things. It's just sometimes they're just a path of sorrow as far as, like, making it work.
I'm guessing some cases it's, like, the rational side of you says, here are all these fringe cases that are going to make this problematic. But just as often, I'm guessing there's an immediate emotional response that just tells you that's a fucking bad idea.
Well, that's the difference between, like, someone who's shipped a game and someone who hasn't shipped a game. It's all about just that gut understanding of that things are always harder than they seem.
Well, in Bioshock 1, we had we did have the slow pro.
Oh, the slow. So there, this guy named the slow. His internal name was the slow pro Fum.
Okay, so FUM stands for fucked up melee. So he had this huge hook at the end, and at the end of his, like, one of his arms, and he would swing it. So,
so it's like slow protector with fucked up melee attack. That was the design spec, basically. Yeah, this is how this stuff starts.
So Art went with it, and to fire his weapon, he would have to actually kneel on the ground and then, like, track the target it was trying to hit. And he walked slow to begin with. That's as fast as he could go. It was like a slow walk. We implemented him exactly as they said we should. And he's trying to follow you. He's going awfully slow. He goes down on one knee and he's about to fire his weapon. So you just go behind geometry. And then he goes, oh, now I have to get back up so I can go attack you over there. So he gets back up. You know, you come out and shoot him a little bit. He goes down on a knee, and then you just run behind something. Now he's like, oh, I have to go shoot him over there. It's the dumbest shit. I mean, and we just looked at it and we're like, no, this is never going to work.
You weren't even willing to entertain the idea that you could change the variables, like, say, reduce the time of his telegraph animation or something. It was just...
No, it's just like, it wasn't even like, it wasn't fun at all. There was no fun to it to be had. So why even try?
Can you think of, like, the converse where you had the wherewithal to just continue to work on something and then you saw that, okay, this is going to take a lot of effort, but it's going to actually add a whole lot. And I'll say it, I was wrong.
In the past games we've worked on, one of the lessons we learned was, like, avoid non-bipedal characters if you can, because they're very difficult to do. And one of the things they had in Bioshock was, I forget what they're called, spider splicers, I think. We call them ceiling crawlers internally. And this is a character where, like, you know, it's running along the ceiling, jumping up and down. And, you know, in the past, we've just sort of avoided those things because they introduce a whole host of problems. But this is, like, one character they really wanted. And, you know, it just took John, like, working every night at home after dinner trying to prove he could make this thing happen. And it turned out to be really cool in the game. And, you know, there's even a third case, which is, like, crazy ideas we had that design doesn't want to do that we end up implementing.
The splicers jumping into water when they're on fire.
Oh, that's right. That was like John and I, like, outside one day talking for 5 minutes. And we were just talking about the things the AI could do. And I was like, you know, we have this water and you can set guys on fire. Wouldn't it be funny if, like, when you set them on fire, they ran and jumped in the water? And John's like, yeah. And then he comes over to me like 10 minutes later. He's like, dude, I coded it up. And it just kind of worked. It worked awesome. And it was just very funny.
Klein says, no do scaly bones, cause we'll be too high. Go and tune your rag dolls.
Part 3, Million Dollar Bender. In 2005, Chris wouldn't need to decline dogs in wheelchairs, and the entire game was destined to die.
You were interested in that, the whole Ghostbusters thing. You were really pushing, like...
Monster in your refrigerator?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember.
Well, let's talk about it. I think it was
Sean wrote it.
Vivendi asked us to do SWAT 5.
Creative director Ken Levine.
And we had just done SWAT 4. Well, I had very little of SWAT 4. These guys, like, totally fucking ran that thing with Chris and as well. And, you know, it wasn't really like on a traditional or rational game, you know, because we didn't bring a lot of our own creativity to it. The guys did an amazing job executing on it, but it wasn't like we were trying to do something radically different. I think visually we did some really cool original stuff.
Yeah, I think we were pointing towards something new because...
Art director Nate Wells.
We were bored, so we basically treated the art as though we were making survival horror.
Yeah.
And that was a straight up tactical shooter.
And it had elements of fear visually and audibly that we didn't have before. And on the design front, you guys, I think, really focused on improving the SWAT 3 experience.
Absolutely.
It was great. SWAT 3 is a great game. And so I think when they asked us to do SWAT 5, where I was sitting creatively, I was like, and I think you guys probably felt the same way. I was like, SWAT 5, like, you know, what are we going to do with it, you know?
I mean, we'll get to hang out with the Boston SWAT team again.
Lead artist Sean Robertson.
That was fun. But
you had such a man crush on that. I remember that guy who came in. He was all muscular.
Shotguns.
They flashbanged your heart, Sean.
I did. That was awesome.
So you know, not to go back on topic, but
No, why would you want to do that?
You know, we didn't really know what to do creatively, and somebody, I can't remember who, started joking about zombie SWAT.
Yeah. Arrest all Draculas.
Yeah.
Kill five wolfmans.
They thought we were joking. I mean, imagine saying zombie SWAT and somebody think you're joking.
You prototyped it?
Yeah, we built a prototype. Like, look, we didn't have a fucking pot to piss in back then. You know, we were basically living from product to project. We had a product that got canceled that almost sunk us. And so we really didn't have any money, so we would have to really scramble between projects and come up with a bunch of prototypes really quickly. Sean, I believe you wrote up a design pitch for it?
I wrote up a design pitch that I called Infection, but it was like this super designer nerdy RPG.
It had a lot of base building, like you'd be working from a base and going out into the zombie area, and you'd meet people and bring them back, and then they would be, you know, engineers, they would develop weapons for you. Yeah, it was very old school. It was almost XCOM.
You'd have to rescue a guy that had a machine gun, and you'd have to figure out where he lived. And then we had this idea of, like, zombie scent, where you could rub dead zombies all over you, which would give you this this ability to walk amongst the zombies as long as you didn't use a weapon for, like, scouting out areas. And strategic goals were, if you got the power plant running in the city, then you could go out at night because then all the lights were on. It just snowballed into this huge epic undertaking.
I think that was one of the most interesting things to me.
Lead designer Bill Gardner.
About that proposal was that, you know, just there were different, you had to make a decision on what part of the city you wanted to go on a mission for. You know, do I want to go help the shotgunner or, like you said, the power plant? And really felt like the whole city had all this stuff going on, and you're sort of the master of your own fate in a way.
Sort of a strategic overlay over the combat experience. But I think at that point, it wasn't like a whole supernatural extravaganza.
I don't think we ever really figured out what the cause was.
Like, I wanted it to be like the last levels where you're walking down the street and you sort of shoot past a zombie and a window goes out and you look in and it's actually a lab and the whole city was just a test bed to see if people could live and survive a zombie attack and therefore they could use this weapon that turns people into zombies.
Oh, God. Just before after the Truman
Show. Soylent Green's people. And yeah, it was really kind of dopey, but it was probably too big a design. And then you came in, Levine.
The question is like what sort of the game mechanic was going to be. I remember thinking about Robotron, you know, like a game that you clearly couldn't win, but it was a trade-off of doing strategic things. Like, do I stop and nail the door shut? Do I stop and heal my friend who's with me? Or do I move forward? Because the monsters would never stop. It was about holding back the horde versus trying to gain strategic advantage. So tactical versus strategic. And it was a really interesting dynamic. And we ended up building this prototype in about, a week or something?
Pretty fast.
Using a lot of SWAT assets. And then we made a couple of, we turned a couple of SWAT dudes, you know, we put zombie face on them.
Made their face pale, put blood on them, and
we Halloweenified them by like 20%.
The coolest thing was that if your teammate got infected and you didn't get to him in time with your antidote, he would change right in front of you. And
right, you see him turn into a zombie. There
come after you. And the whole thing was like, we wanted to pull your heartstring, like, oh, I don't want to shoot Fred because he was just my friend. And I mean, it was kind of cool that this guy, went from helping you to becoming a zombie.
But what happened after that? Because that's been a problem with all games of that nature. Like,
well, you had a window. You had a window to heal him. I mean, you had to get over there.
If you didn't heal him, he was a zombie. You killed him.
Yeah, then was he just out of the game.
He was out of the game. Yeah,
if you
fuck you.
But there was a period of time where you had to decide. Do I have time to heal him, or should I just shoot him because he was going to turn into an enemy soon?
Yeah.
But you didn't want to just shoot him because you could turn and potentially save him, and losing one of your friends was a big deal during the course of a mission.
No thoughts to borrow from Robert Kirkman in Walking Dead, like you get bit in the hand, cut off the
this
hand.
This was before.
This was before.
This was, I think, before.
This was like 2003 or something.
Oh, yeah, it was before. Well, I mean, like Resident Evil was the only game in town for zombies, really, and for movies, you know, before 28 Days Later.
And we were inspired by. I think what we were frustrated by is we love Resident Evil, but we felt it didn't really capture sort of that. The apocalyptic nature of a lot of like the Dawn of the Dead movies.
And the boarding up like was a real thing. Like the original Night of the Living Dead, the only verb they use to keep the zombies off is continually boarding up windows and doors.
Dawn of the Dead, they were barricading themselves, and there was a whole like, we need to get food, we need to get all these things that weren't in those games that we wanted, that survivalist nature.
And that was the thing that really appealed to me when you were originally pitching the game, is that you said, you know, the thing that zombie games are missing up until this point is that you want to hunker down, but you got to go out from your safe house. Yeah. You know, it's that you got to put yourself in a vulnerable position.
It's tactical versus strategic.
Exactly,
like, you want to survive, but you need to do these things because you're running out of food, you're running out of medicine, and that's the power of all those Dawn of the Dead style movies. Like, fuck, we have to leave our safe haven.
You'd get to the kitchen of this apartment, and you could board that up, and you'd maybe have a couple minutes. You know, in the demo, they get through doors really quickly, but we talked about other means that would maybe hold them off, or and then presumably time-based things that you could do in that room to strengthen your group and move on.
Since this game that never was can be anything I want, will you lie to me and say that like you could scrounge for gasoline and then periodically drive a car to one of the distant like power stations and run?
Yes, no.
Yes, Sean. Yes, of course no. You could. Don't be ridiculous. We would pass on something like that.
No, I mean, you know, when we were taking this on the road, obviously one of the first things the publishers tend to come back with is other vehicles, right? You know,
and we would,
we would lie and say,
"Oh yeah, there's totally gonna be vehicles." Don't worry
about
it.
Flying where you
flying zombie dragons.
Yeah, fly over the here there be dragons. We had a lot of dragons. Yeah, there was
Dragon Rain.
There was a spaceship you could pilot, and I think there was a full baseball season.
The spaceship was unlockable though, right? It was like $5.99.
Yeah, you also had to.
Yeah, it was DLC. It was DLC. The spaceship. Yeah,
absolutely. You had to manage a soccer team the whole time, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. You had to manage
just football, but just in like a spreadsheet.
Yeah. Absolutely, Australian rules football. We had the game pretty much had everything,
and
pretty
much zombie sex.
Any zombie game that came after it. Or any game that came after it, I think was a direct copy of this game. We had every idea for every game prior to every other game.
So no publishers wanted to bite at this thing, but I mean, were you convinced that it was a game you wanted?
That's
to work
tough
on?
To say. We couldn't shop it, right?
Actually, a publisher did bite. Vivendi wasn't interested at first, but we actually sold it to them. But then here's what happened. So we had set up BioShock with Take-Two, and we had two teams. You know, we had one team was doing BioShock, and the Australian team still needed a project to do. They did their own prototype, which is really cool.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And we took it out, and we actually were able to get Vivendi really interested. And right when I was about to sell the company, you know, somehow we ended up getting our wires crossed, and we told Vivendi, oh yeah, we're going to do that deal with you. We're going to do Division 9 with you guys, and thanks for the offer, and we're going to take it. And we were just about to sell the company at the same time, and obviously we couldn't do both. So we actually got somebody to buy the game. It was just too late for us. We were already committed to moving down a different road. It was, I think, the only game we ever sold but never did.
Part 4, McDonough the Dead. Once the studio settled on a concept for Division 9, Director of Creative Development Joe McDonough pitched it to publishers. At first, he sort of sucked at it. His story highlights yet another stumbling block in the never-ending series of live-or-die decisions that threaten big ideas.
All right, so I think it's fair to say that I blagged my first job here. I didn't really have any qualifications. I was just a game designer. And somehow, I don't know how, but I talked Ken into doing it, right? I was based in Australia. He flew me here. To check out Division 9. And he says to me, right, look, here's the game. I want you to go out on the road. I want you to sell it. First of all, he gets me to give this fake pitch to Sean and Nate and the guys just to see if I can do it. So I get up and I start giving this PowerPoint presentation. And I can just see everybody's eyes just kind of like rolling over with boredom. And Ken stops me halfway through and he goes, Joe, this is terrible. I feel like you're going to offer me a cup of tea and a scone. It's got to be like this. And he gets up and goes, you're in a world gone crazy, surrounded by hideous monsters. And I'm thinking, I can't do this. There's no way I could do this, but I'll give it a go. So I'm writing these notes down, right? And I'm walking around Boston, like the weekend. People must have thought I was a fucking nutter. There's this English bloke walking around, reading from this script, trying to memorize it, going, you're in this world gone crazy, surrounded by hideous monsters. So I memorized this script, right? And he sends me out on the road. And I got 5 meetings lined up with all the top publishers. And I have to say, I was absolutely crapping it. Because I didn't really... Like, I thought I could do it. I'd done some pitching before. But this is really serious, right? So anyway, I've memorized the script. Go to the first meeting. It's like one of the biggest publishers in the world. Huge building. Go in there, 5 serious guys. And I'm really nervous. Like, my hands are shaking and stuff. I get into the pitch. And they're responding really well. It gets to this point where I'm just introducing the game. There's this really important mechanic in it, right? You've got these 2 companions. And rather than having these kind of meathead companions, we wanted real people like hairdressers and accountants. And the idea is they're sort of really shitting it. So you've got to keep their morale up by tapping this button. Bang, 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 bang. Because he starts going, oh my God. And you press the button and it goes, get up, you piece of shit, get up. And it's kind of cool. And it was a cool mechanic because it was about time management, right? It's like all the time you're doing that, you can't be shooting, right? So I give the guy a big pitch. I'm going, and look, my guy's freaking out, right? Look, I'm going to really sort him out now. Watch this. And I go to press a button because my hand is shaking so much. I press the fire button and I shoot the guy in the head. And the guy just dies in front of me. And all these executives just look at me. Silence. Guy says to me, gee, well, that will really sort him out.
Part 5, Winning Hand. Is it fun? If the answer isn't yes, nothing's sacred, not even artist Stephen Alexander's glorious Hangina.
The Hangina was this idea that we had for projectile thrown plasmids like the Enrage and Security Bullseye. In the game, we made them these sort of like mucus balls. They were like full of juice or whatever. And initially, my implementation was that you had this, almost like this orifice in the palm of your hand. And when you would throw one, there was this animation that would play where the hand kind of like turned a little bit towards the screen and would like strain. And you'd see the orifice kind of opening up and it would sort of start to push out, sort of like a crowning kind of shape. And like juice would kind of squirt out and then the hand would like push and it would pop out into your palm with like accompanying spray of goop and stuff like that. It was really foul. It was all, we wanted the plasma stuff to be really visceral and try not to be magical. And so this was like going way down that road. I don't know. I really liked it. I thought it was pretty cool. It's in the game, but what happened was is that we had to, because of the amount of time it took to birth one, there was like a feeling among the, you know, designers and I think everybody eventually that it was just, there was too much downtime between being able to throw another one. So if you missed with your security bullseye, you had to wait a while for the next one to pop out. So we just kept speeding it up until now it's like 5 or 6 frames, which is, you know, like 1/5 of a second. The orifice is still there and it still squirts some juice and everything, but you just can't even register it because it goes so fast. When it got to the point where you couldn't read what was going on anymore, it was a bummer. But, I mean, it served the greater good. It was more fun as a result. So.
Part 6, Armed Dispute. Now and then, Ken comes to a conclusion and says, make it so. But what when the trusted instincts of veteran artists such as Nate Wells and Rob Waters tell them otherwise?
At some point, Ken came to you guys, said the Big Daddy needed a drill on his hand.
Well, he didn't so much say it as he demanded it. It was our first big pre-rendered video. And Ken was writing the script. 2 of the things it demanded. One was that the Big Daddy have this huge drill on his hand. Now, at the time, Big Daddy just had 2 hands. I think he had like a rock crusher on each hand. That was the way I originally drew it. Ken also demanded that there would be this big drill arm on it, which... Rob and I both thought was completely video game, over the top, not what we wanted. And so we definitely resisted it. But it became clear that we weren't going to be able to resist it. So between the two of us, Rob designed the drill, put it on there, and I did the mounting for it. But before that, like, this was weeks and weeks. We were so pissed off about it that we just kept sending these drawings back and forth to each other of, you know, the left hand deleted and in its place would be like, I think the first one Rob sent was like a marshmallow, like a campfire marshmallow on his hand instead. And then I just would send a picture back of like a guy's ass. And then he'd send something back and then it got completely pornographic. And then, you know, until like, it was like totally unacceptable images. But we, you know, we did it. We had to do it. And, you know, it turns out Ken was right. He really wouldn't have read as the character he read as. Without the drill, I don't think. And, you know, this was a demand for an ad. And sometimes you do things in a teaser video, and then you have, for example, there was no plasmid that caused bugs to get, come flying out of your arms before that ad. Ken said, okay, and then this ad, he shoots himself with a plasmid, and then his arm bubbles up, and the bees come out, and they go into the hole that he shot in the Big Daddy's head. There was no plasmid that did that. We had to make it because of that video. We had to go back and figure out how to do it in game, and it was not easy. It was probably one of the most complex plasmid effects you had to do. And this is just from being like, man, wouldn't it be cool if we did this in the commercial? And then you have to do it. You actually have to do it. And in both cases in this, I think both the drill arm and the swarm, the bees, were a great idea.
I assume that when you first start on a project, you feel really proprietary where you're keeping track of every contribution you've made. But I'm curious if that changes over time, especially when you've been with the company for years and years.
I've been doing this for about 12 years. Rob's been doing it that long, too. And what you learn is that you want to be attached to your work or stuff that you do enough to care about it to make it good. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to let everything go. If you focus too much on ownership, your head will explode. You're never going to get things in 100% the way you would want them because every asset's a compromise. So design has to give a little, art has to give a little. And then once art and design have made their choice, programming has to say no to certain behaviors or certain implementations or, hey, the number of these guys you can have in a level. So everybody has to give something back from their pure vision. So you learn to love what you've made, but you always have it in the back of your head that it could go at any second.
This podcast was produced by Jim Bonney and Sean Elliott. Music for this podcast was provided by Zooted Granny, Matt Grimm, Jeff Graves, Jim Bonney, The Razors, and Giancarlo Feltrin. Sean Robertson, tell me about the baddest box art you can possibly conceive of.
Dog in a wheelchair.
Sean Robertson, what is the illest multiplayer scene you can ever imagine? I mean a good one.
You walk by an alley and you see the shadow of a dog in a wheelchair go by an alley and that's it. Just let people wonder.
Sean Robertson, if you were in control of BioShock's marketing, what would the number one bullet point on the back of the box have been?
Dog in a wheelchair.
On that same note, Sean Robertson, what would the in-store standee for BioShock have been?
Just the dog in a wheelchair.
Sean Robertson, tell me your number one album of all time.
The dog in a wheelchair.
Sean Robertson, what was your SAT score?
Dog in a wheelchair.
Sean Robertson, what do you visualize when your wife's not doing it for you?
A frog with a funnel coming out of its ass.
Sean Robertson, if you were ever on the Wheel of Fortune, what puzzle would you prefer to play?
Dog in a wheelchair.
Sean Robertson, what does the baby changing table in the Superdome smell like?
Dog in a wheelchair.
Sean Robertson, if you were to cosplay as any character from a video game, what would that character be?
A dog in a wheelchair.
Sean Robertson, it's the 11th inning and the score is tied. Who do you put on the mound?
Dog in a wheelchair. Dog in a wheelchair. Dog in a wheelchair.
That was fucking stupid.